Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river, do we recreate ourselves? What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Char and Trev, who came up with this idea. Welcome to today's V-Wave Podcast. Our guests today include Steve Lantic, Steve's son Connor, and their friend Mark Churchill. Gentlemen, welcome to the V-Wave. Steve, let's start with you. You have created a very fascinating boat that you just took through Grand Canyon a few months ago. Can you tell me about this boat and how you created it and why you created it?
Well, I think I've had the idea in the back of my head for a long time. I did a long canoe trip with a friend of mine 30 or 45 years ago, and we actually catamaraned our two single canoes together for when we paddled on the Pacific Ocean and in a few other places on our trip. And so when I started to contemplate going through the Grand Canyon, I thought, well, no reason why it wouldn't work with two tandem canoes. And so, you know, that was in the back of my mind. And I have been applying for the permit for 30-some years.
Oh, my gosh.
Finally won it. So, you know, and then I had to put the plan into action. And, you know, in a perfect world, I would have bought two brand new canoes that were more suited to the purpose. But I had two canoes, and they were, I think, a little bit, they're fast canoes, a little bit longer with less rocker than would be ideal. But the biggest drawback of the canoes that we had was they weren't built, particularly one of them, was not built to take a hard hit.
Ah.
And so, I mean, if I, you know, had it to do over again, I would take some canoes that were built with no core and no ribs, and they could really take a punch better.
Oh, wow. Okay. How did you, so I don't know anyone who's taken a tandem canoe through the Grand Canyon in a catamaran shape. So the forces involved, I should mention, Steve, that in 1983 with Verlin Kruger, you canoed up the Grand Canyon on a 28,000 mile journey.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And part of that journey was up running the Colorado River from the Sea of Cortez, all the way then up the Green. And so that's a huge journey. You'd been through the Grand Canyon. You'd seen the water and the hydraulics, the rapids. So the concept of taking two canoes and hooking them together, what did you need to do to strengthen these boats? And what kind of crossbars did you use?
The one of the canoes I made from scratch.
Okay.
And that one was built so it actually was a lot stronger. The other one was old Winona, a lightweight foam core Kevlar canoe that I raced in a long time ago. And so I put a whole other layer. We all worked together on it, put a layer on the outside. I reinforced the gunnels, reinforced all the ribs. But the biggest consideration was to have the sleeves, which the catamaran poles went through, you know, attached to each canoe very securely. So I kind of probably, well, I might have over-engineered that, but that was the critical thing, and that was what I was most concerned about, particularly the first couple days. You know, you said that I was familiar with the hydraulics from paddling up, you know, years ago, but actually that's not really true, because when we paddled up, we portaged, you know, all the heavy rapids.
Oh, and right. So, yeah.
It was a totally different experience being out there in those hydraulics. And I wasn't sure the first couple of days if the catamaran system would hold together, or those, you know, the poles and the sleeves might rip right out, but they didn't. So I guess it worked.
Okay. And did you run all the rapids?
No, we did, absolutely did not. And actually, we are, just before our conversation here, we've been talking about the idea of doing another run, and the goal would be to run all the rapids. And right. and I think, you know, it's a good chance we could have done it this time, but we were being conservative. You know, we didn't want to get halfway through the canyon and have the thing break apart and then try to figure out how we're going to get it out of there. And
right.
The hulls were not up to what I think we need, you know, to really, you know, be able to take the chance, I guess, of running all the rapids. So,
okay. So let me make sure I get this right. And the hulls, you mentioned the hulls weren't up to speed. That would be the Winona that wasn't up to speed.
Well, in terms of strength.
Yes. In terms of strength. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though I did reinforce it quite a bit.
Okay.
The issue is when you put a core in a canoe, the reason that manufacturers do that is so they can make light canoes, and the core, you know, stops the boat from flexing, and that flex is exactly what you need if you're going to hit something.
Yeah.
So the canoe was stronger, but it was still way too stiff.
Okay. So in the rapids that you did run, what was the most technical rapid that you ran?
Oh, wow. These guys got to help me on that one. The most technical, that's a good question.
Well, according to the book, you know, the Belknap book, we slid right through house rock with no issues at all. But, you know, those ratings,
bedrock,
yeah, not house rock. We portaged house rock, but okay. Bedrock, I believe it's a 9 or so. And we looked at it, we were intimidated by the talk from the commercial companies going through, like, you guys better really be careful about house rock. Well, we put out River Right at the top of it, looked at it, and our support crew was a little more cautious than we were, because they could get pinned on that. But we looked at it as just two completely separate rivers.
Uh-huh.
And we say River Right, and it was the easiest rapid that we probably ran the whole trip.
Oh, okay. Let's be clear. We're not talking about house rock. We're talking about bedrock. Bedrock has the big island in the middle, and you want to make the right channel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
and Mark, you've got a nice video of that on your Facebook page. You guys just made it look super simple, super easy.
Right, so that's pretty much what I was talking about. It was simple. So some of the other ones that were rated as far as the Belknap system goes,
mm-hmm.
maybe some of the 6s, and I can't really tell you what they were exactly, we would portage them, because there'd be a big hole there. So I think their system is more for the rafts than it is for anything else.
That's true. So what rapids did you portage?
Oh, my, you know, it would be very hard for us. We didn't record it. We didn't write it down.
Okay.
And, you know, if we went through the book page by page,
you could figure it out.
We probably could figure out a lot of it, but.
But it sounds like you portaged Horn Creek.
Yeah.
This is just below Phantom.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of little poral kind of dome or bit in the middle at the top, and it's a short, sharp drop.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But
And some of these rapids, of course, we didn't actually portage, we lined them, like Lava Falls, you know. Okay. That was a fairly easy line. It would have been we scouted the portage first, and it would have been a really rough portage.
Yep.
And the lining wasn't too bad.
Was that on river right or river left?
River left.
Okay, great. I'm thinking about something like Dubendorf, or you've got a nice video of running Hermit wide open. That's great. That looked good.
Yeah. Dubendorf, I believe, was the one that we portaged on the right, but we didn't get down to the bottom of it. We put in before the end of it.
Okay.
And we just had to do an upstream ferry at the, you know, closer to the bottom.
Yeah.
And we slid over there to the eddy on the river left.
Yeah.
And it was good, you know.
So, yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay.
That was probably one of the dicier situations we were in that I felt.
Why is that, Mark?
It was an upstream ferry.
Okay.
So we would spin the boat around, face it upstream, and we were caught in a pretty good eddy on the left, on river right.
Okay.
Because our left when we're facing upstream. And then keeping that angle of the boat, but Connor and I were following Steve's direction, and we stayed right in the trough of that wave. And looking back on it, it was pretty intimidating at the moment. But once we made it clear to the other side, uh-huh. It was smooth sailing. And we gave the dories, there were some dories down there, and we gave them a little show, I think.
Cool. Very cool. What is portaging a boat like that? Like, I mean, did you break it apart into two canoes that weren't connected together and just walk them down like that?
The system came apart pretty easily.
Okay.
So we just had some pins. We popped the pins out, and yeah, it would have been very challenging to portage them, you know, intact as a catamaran. So
got it. Yeah. What was your most challenging portage? Was that then Dubendorf, where you put back in, you know, halfway down and then peeled out and made the run?
Well, no. Well,
Dubendorf was pretty easy.
Yeah. Right? That's what I remember. Yeah. The portage.
Yeah. It was just some big rocks, no big inclines or anything.
Right.
And, you know, thank goodness we had, you know, the other crew. We didn't do this solo. We did it with three rafts. So a lot of the guys would go through the rapid with their rafts and be a safety boat for us. And in some cases, they would come back up. They would walk up where we were, and then would help us porting the canoe down.
Okay.
So that was a big savings there, because it get a little rough in there at times.
Okay.
I would say that the portages were my biggest concern, just because it seemed to me it would be so easy to get hurt, you know, carrying the boat, you know, over those rocks, and, you know, and some of them, you know, pretty slick. And you know, I felt better on the water than I did on those portages, but, you know, that might be because I'm 73 too.
Oh no, Steve, you are exactly right. If you look at the historical record from the days when people were portaging the canyon because they didn't like the looks of the whitewater, the broken legs and broken ankles and twisted distance and that's portaging is not easy. It is as or more dangerous as running the rapids, and the early river runners figured that out, and that's why we don't do that anymore. I mean, it's a tool in our toolbox, but it's down there, you know, with the bottom of the box all rusted, because that's one of the reasons I'm interested in your trip, is you guys were actually doing something that a last record I have of doing that in the Grand Canyon intentionally was in the 60s. I'm sure people occasionally do it today, even pack rafters do it all the time, not a big deal, but for larger boats, big trips, to get those big boats around rapids is a lot of work.
Tom, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Now there are what, 200 rapids in the river?
Sure. Well, I'll say yes. I don't know. We have to count them. And what size do you want to limit it to? And blah blah.
Yeah. Right. So we were talking about this after the trip, as we were kind of Miller alone. You know, it was probably somewhere between 10 and 12 times that we probably either lined it or portaged the rapid.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Probably once a day on the average. So yeah. Maybe we didn't have any.
Yeah, 10 or 12. Yeah,
total.
That's conservative, I would say.
Maybe a little more.
I would think, yeah.
Okay. Maybe 15. Hours.
Tough to say, but
it was pretty time consuming.
Yes, it is. You
know, yeah.
Because there's two boats. We're actually portaging twice.
That's right. That's right.
So
yeah, I mean, you have to take the boats apart. You have to carry them down one at a time. You have to put them back together.
Right. You bring one down, you got to go back and get the next one.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So, yeah.
If you ran the river again, would you, you know, it sounds like, Steve, if you didn't have the Winona and you had like your other boat that you built, which is a Kevlar, an open Kevlar boat, and it's a beautiful boat. I had a chance to see your boats before you guys launched. Really, in amazing craftsmanship.
Thank you.
It's a question of, okay, I'm thinking about a rapid like Dubendorf. It's got a fairly large center hole. What kind of forces? I don't see it flipping. I don't see a boat like that flipping. It's not going to end over end. It's going to do this, the bow of one of the boats is going to go up while the bow of the other boat is going to want to go down. And what does that do to the catamaran form strong enough to handle that?
Well, I think we put that to the test it held together, right? And it's still just like it was when we started. So,
whoa.
I built the sleeves, and they were really heavy duty sleeves. Right. And, and then it was critical to really put extra reinforcement to hold the sleeves into the canoes. So, I think that's the most critical thing of the whole structure. And, the idea of being able to do that with no portaging would be pretty appealing to me.
Yeah, I can certainly see why.
Partly because the portages were dangerous, but just because it would be so much fun to be able to pull that off.
What were some of the big hits that you remember taking that were like, we survived that?
Well, actually, the only time we really hit anything of significance was the first day. And that really was, I think we let our guard down. You know, I'm calling the shots. So, it was my fault. But we'd run. I can't remember. It might have been House Rock. But you do remember what rapid that was? But when we hit that
rapid. Reportage House
Rock. Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't House Rock. It was a very long rapid.
Soapy creek.
Yeah. But, that could be. We'd run the bulk of the rapid and then we just kind of, let our guard down and we went up against the rock on our right side, but, we brushed off of it and we cracked some ribs on the canoe and cracked the gunwale, but other than that, it was fine. So, that was just not, you kind of partly getting used to the system and just being more focused.
Okay.
So,
had four guys in the boat still at that point.
Yeah, that's true.
We decided to take one of our bow paddlers out and only have three guys paddling.
Yeah.
And that actually worked a lot better.
Why?
We were able to steer the boat better and make directional changes quicker because there's less weight in the front of the canoe.
Oh.
And I think not all of us were on the same page.
Okay.
And everybody has to be locked in on the same page, taking direction from one guy without hesitating. Otherwise, we're going to run into some stuff. So we intended to work. We decided it worked better having three guys.
Okay.
We ran it that way for the rest of the trip after that.
And it from the videos I've seen, which are on Facebook, it looks like you guys were comfortably maintaining I think I'd like to say a 10 mile an hour speed.
Oh boy. It obviously it varies so much with the, speed of the current.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we probably in flat water wouldn't paddle at the, you know, we weren't racing, so right. we might have been cruising between 5.5 miles an hour in if it was flat water. So you know, just add the current speed to that.
Right.
So I don't think there's that many, you know, in between the rapids, there's right. not many places that we would have been going 10. That would have been, you know, in the rapids, yeah, but probably more like, you know, 8.
Yeah, I had it on my GPS on my Strava,
mm-hmm.
and our moving time, not, and that includes, because it was on my wrist, walking back and forth with the portages,
yep.
that's a way we could figure out which ones we portage, is look at my Strava and see where we're walking.
Good idea.
But at the end of the day, that was usually around 6 miles an hour total.
Yeah.
But wow. Including time, portages.
That includes the portages, walking back and forth a couple times.
Wow.
So I just looked at it real quick. And it's been a month since we've been off the river. Maybe that's will be my assignment, to go back and try to figure out which ones we actually portage.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be good. Connor, I want to ask you, what were some of the highlights of this trip for you?
Well, one, anytime I get to do a trip with my dad, it's always a big highlight for me.
No kidding. Yeah.
I started going on trips with him when I was, I don't know, I'm 5 years old, and we've done a lot of that together.
Cool.
So that's always probably the biggest special thing for me, is just getting to be on adventures with him. And then to get to go back to the place, you know, I've been here. My dad's kind of been a hero of mine my whole life, obviously, and all of his adventures, and hearing about him going up this, you know, the Colorado River, that up through the Grand Canyon, and, you know, knowing he's the only, him and Verlin are the only two people we know of that have ever done that. And to go and to get to go back to that place with him and actually see what he did, and to see how, I mean, when you're going down that river, it looks like you're paddling down a mountain at times. It's just like you look down the corner and it's just going straight down, and to realize the scope of what they actually accomplished coming up was just really wild. It just felt like I felt more a part of, or my understanding for what they did on their trip just went through the roof there. And also getting to make new and kind of strengthen bonds I already have, getting to know Mark better. And anytime you go through, you know, that's a tough thing we did, and it's scary a lot of times. So when you go and you do something like that as a team, it really strengthens that bond. So
yeah,
that was really special for me as well.
Cool. And Mark, same question to you.
Well, you know, I got to just echo a lot of what Connor just said. Steve and I taught together for, I don't know, we were right next to each other teaching 7th and 8th graders in Negaunee Middle School for 20 plus years together.
Okay.
And between classes, you know, that was like, okay, we have 5 minutes. We're going to pick up where our last conversation went. And a lot of times this trip, not this trip, but the 83 trip that Verlin and he did, would come up. And, of course, I had questions, you know. And there was always a question. And Steve, more than not, didn't have enough time to finish the answer because we had to get back with the kids. So seeing that river from that perspective, very similar to what Connor said, was cool, because I think at one spot, maybe on top of Sock Dolliger, there's a picture of Steve in 1983, like flexing his muscles. and so Connor and he recreated that.
Oh, wow.
Sock Dolliger this year, where that creek comes in,
uh-huh.
The river left where that big boulder is. Well, the boulder's getting there a little deeper than that, but that's where they took the picture. So
okay.
I haven't seen the 83 compared to the 26 one yet, but it's probably in Steve's house here someplace.
Hmm. Nice.
So yeah, those, you know, just solidifying friendships and getting to know Connor a little bit more. I've been on a few things with Steve, so, you know, that was the highlight for me, and I'm looking forward to going back.
Very fun. Did you guys take out at Diamond Creek, or did you go to Pierce Ferry?
You asking me or Steve or Connor?
I'm asking you, gentlemen.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll start and then they can add. Well, we, at Red Cavern, we ran into a commercial guide. He was in a rafting group. And, they basically had the same itinerary as we did. They were going to take out at Pierce. Okay. Well, after talking to him and realizing, that our rafts might not be able to go beyond Diamond Creek, we started hemming and hawing, and then these portages, you know, a few of them were getting a little rougher than what we anticipated. We thought we might run out of time.
Okay.
And we wanted to do some hikes. So that's when we decided maybe we ought to just pull out. We didn't want to, but in order to make the cutoff for 16 days, we felt we could go a little more relaxed and get to Diamond Creek, and still get there for Sabre to pick us up.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So I was going to ask you about, 232 mile, which is a rapid down below Diamond. And I see you guys just acing that with this boat, you know, come in on the right and just do a cross current downstream ferry and just power right on through that thing. Cause you basically have the power to move that boat really well. From what I've seen on the film. So I and then of course there's down below separation, there's a ton of flat water and you guys would just gobble that up.
We wouldn't have had a problem with it, but we think our rafts were.
Yeah, you would have let them and you'd gotten the takeout and they'd had all the cold beers back in the rafts and they'd been laughing at you and you'd been wondering where are they? Yeah. Okay. Get it back to Steve. So I'm going to ask you kind of what you would do different next time would be to have a better canoe to kind of match the good one that you had. What else would you do different?
We're definitely going on to Pierce Ferry for the takeout, and we'd probably add a couple of days, make it maybe 18 instead of 16. I think that would be good. And the biggest thing that we would want to do different is not portage. Yep. So that would definitely be high on the list. And I think I would set up the canoes, pretty much the same as I set these ones up. We had a really high seats, higher than you would in a standard tandem canoe.
Okay.
And you get a little more leverage when you sit higher.
Okay.
And it's more comfortable, the higher you sit. So that would be true. I think I would be tempted to install electric battery operated bilge pumps because Mark and I definitely spent some time bailing at the end of Rapids.
That's a really good idea. Yep.
Yeah. I think that those are the things that definitely come to mind right now anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Steve, your thoughts on your reflections on this river trip now, just overall. Did you have a good time?
Yeah. I mean, I suspect that you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who said they didn't have a good time that went through that canyon. I mean, it's been 43 years since I've been in it, but boy, I tell you, it felt like almost like I hadn't been there before. It was so, awesome that, I'm sure similar to the way most people feel, it's just overwhelming really that such a spectacular canyon, such a really spectacular river runs through such a spectacular canyon. And one of the things that I really appreciated on our trip was that we had clear water the whole way. And we didn't have that back when I did it before. And I just love that water. It was just so pretty. And actually, it every day it got a little warmer, so we could swim in it. And it was just, you know, the hydraulics and the way that river moves is just symphony, I guess. I don't know. Just incredible. So
yeah. Was there anything that you remembered from uprunning in 83, paddling your canoes, you and Verlin, that you saw or recognized on the downrun? I'm just trying to think about, I mean, the two trips are very different. Muscle-powered uprun of the Grand Canyon and a muscle-powered downrun of the Grand Canyon. The uprun in a single canoe with your gear in it, and then the downrun in this canoe catamaran, very different. But were there any things you remembered from that 83 run that you were like, oh my gosh, look at that?
You know, not much really. It's, I guess, that 43 years really affects, how well, you don't remember the details.
Yeah, sure.
Over 43 years, and probably the reason that I remember that one spot where Connor took that picture of me right above Psychology is because I had a picture of it. So was I remembering the actual picture or when I was there? But, there were places, I guess, that I remember kind of camping out, a few, not many.
Uh-huh.
I definitely did not have a clear memory of Lava Falls because, when I think about that, it doesn't seem like it was a hard portage. And Mark and I scouted that whole portage this time, and it would have been, we could have done it, but it would have been a lot harder than what I remember it. I'll put it that way.
Right. You could get right up to the base of the falls on River Left. And then it's a pretty quick portage there back in the 83. The vegetation wouldn't have been as heavy as it is now. And you'd been able to get right along and up on top of the rapid. It was back before the 60s. I mean, that rapid was a portaged and lined a lot on River Left.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. It did seem like it had changed to me. So.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely has flash flooded since 83 and is considerably different. Some of the things are the same, but some other things are different. So, what else? What am I forgetting to ask here?
Guys, think of anything?
No, I don't got anything.
There was one little spot. You asked Steve about some dicey areas, or
yeah.
There was one other spot, and it was an unnamed rapid just below Els Chasm.
Okay.
And there's a, I believe it's unnamed. Connor and I were up there at the waterfall, and we came down, and our boats, our rafts had gone through. And as we were watching them go through, we could see the bath of one of them just kind of bobbed down, like the stern of the boat just kind of dropped of the raft and popped right up. No, okay, that's what rafts do. Well, when we went through it, they're waiting for us below as a safety boat. There was something in the water, and later on we heard it was a boil. We come around the corner, and the next thing we know, Steve and I have water up to our rib cage, and Connor's at a 45 degree angle up in the air. Something just pulled us right down.
Wow.
And there was a sandbar to the right. So thank goodness we were able to paddle over there, and the raft came and helped us out. But that was a little, if that would have been at the beginning of a longer rapid, we probably would have had some real serious issues. But thank goodness that sandbar was right there, and we were able to hop out
and bail out. Yeah.
Yeah. And bail out. Yeah. Cause the water was right to our rib cages, and we had these massive air bladders in there to keep things afloat. And Connor's just waving air with his paddle.
Oh my gosh. Huh. yeah,
we're lucky that didn't happen during a longer rapid, because if it had, we would have been in trouble there, because we wouldn't have been able to steer the boat that well. We would have been tippier with water in it, obviously, but mostly just steering. So
right, and it's not like you guys have spray skirts and you can keep the water out of the canoe. You do have.
We definitely have spray skirts. We should have showed those to you. Yeah, we know the whole boat was pretty much covered.
So where'd the water get in then?
Well, on that particular incident.
Yeah.
They're not watertight. In the bow, we had neoprene spray skirts in the bow of both boats, but in the stern, we just had nylon covers with Velcro on the side of the boat that were like lap pieces. So there was definitely areas, you know, particularly behind our, you know, behind us, immediately behind us there.
In the stern.
Yeah. It's just that the whole boat got full of the water. So it's going to fill up.
Got it. Interesting. I hadn't appreciated that could happen. My running assumption was, that with the air chambers, the air bladders in the canoes, that filling with water wouldn't be such an issue.
Well, we didn't have the whole canoes filled with air bladders. Like, you know, you got guys that run whitewater in open canoes, mm-hmm. they try to get those whole canoes filled up with air bladders.
Right, right.
And we just had a center bladder, basically. That was a big center airbag, and that was it. So the ends of the boat definitely had, you know, there's a lot of space in there that wasn't filled with flotation.
Okay. It sounds like you guys are thinking about running again, and I look forward to the changes you will make in this watercraft. I'm not sure that we're seeing the beginning of transitioning to canoe catamarans in Grand Canyon, but we might be. I never know these things. So I wish you all the best of luck in continuing with your prototype to refine it and make the run all the way down to Pierce and maybe make another or two or three after that.
Yeah. You mentioned the speed run I, like my dad said, that interests me quite a bit. And I personally think that running, you know, as long as the water levels don't continue to drop, that doing another just trip that without doing it for speed would really help us prepare even better to do a speed run if we could go back a third time.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit. I don't have my speed run notes with me here. The individual that has the record didn't do it on a lot of water. What that individual did was just never stopped paddling. And that's where the speed run is today. I mean, Grand Canyon speed run, there's every boat is different. You know, every record holder in quotes, there was a motor powered run that had the first record. Then that was broken by an oar powered run. And then eventually that was broken, you know, by another motor powered run. That was broken by another oar powered run. So it's like, if you're just looking for sheer speed, that's being done now by men and women who just don't stop paddling. It's an Olympic, this is an Olympic contest.
You got to remember, Tom, I wouldn't call it an Olympic contest because the Olympics don't have marathon racing, but all three of us have a background. I mean, my whole life I've been racing marathon canoes, and I've, you know, Texas Water Safari, Yukon River Quest. I mean, I've been in a lot of long races.
Okay.
So it's just like any sport. It's a specialty, and you know, anybody can do it, but you know, experience is what matters. And even the guy that has the record, I don't think he was per se a marathon paddler. So that game is what we know. So we would definitely have that advantage. We know how to paddle all day and all night without stopping.
Right. Well, that's what it's come down to. That's exactly what it's come down to. I won't say about the skills of the current record holder. I think they did an amazing job.
Yeah, I agree.
But if you think that record is challengeable, you're certainly right, because the individual has the challenge. Spent almost, I believe, 30 minutes going around in an eddy below lava with boat in one hand, paddle in another, and a spray and a dry suit that had its zipper open.
Mm. Oh,
so he was filling with water, but he made it. If foot touched the ground, he was able to get the boat to shore, bail it out, bail himself out, get back in the boat, and take off. And that same gentleman just did a family trip this last winter. So you know, it's still out there boating.
Is his name Ben Orkin?
Yes, Ben Orkin. Thank you very much.
34 hours and 2 minutes.
And I think you guys can break that.
Yeah, well, like my dad said, the biggest advantage just comes from the utility of the design of the boat, right? Because we can have three guys paddling at all times. When you're in a solo canoe, anytime you have to eat or put your paddle down, the boat, the speed of the boat stops so much. And if the benefit to one of the big benefits of that catamaran when it comes to a speed run is not just the stability and the ability to run the rapids cleanly, but in all of those flat sections, we can have one guy, he could rest, he can sit there and eat, he can turn around, and you know, the boat's so stable and comfortable that I think to me is what would give us the biggest advantage. And like you said, three guys or four guys paddling all the time versus one guy paddling. I think that's, like you said, that's where the big advantage would come in for us. So,
right. And of this, I know nothing except there it is in front of you.
Yeah.
to give it a go. There was a very large catamaran type boat with a whole bunch of rowing stations on it that attempted a run, and they damaged that boat severely in Lava Falls, and that put them out of the running. There it is. And Ben might be someone you want to contact and ask him, you know, for some tips that he has. But again, it isn't, people aren't looking for high water anymore.
Right.
They're looking for the water that they have. They start at midnight and off they go. And you have to kind of time things because ideally you want to try to run the Upper Granite Gorge in the daylight. And that means...
Is that going all the way to Pierce? Is that where they're finishing?
The Grand Wash Cliffs at River Mile 277.
Okay.
This opens up and you need to have some sort of in-reach thing that's a device that's putting out a signal, and you'll have a whole bunch of people watching that signal as you go through the Grand Canyon, and they'll be working out the times. And that's just what it is. Now me, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to race through Paradise. I'm an old guy. Yeah, I'm dragging my feet. I'm throwing out the anchors. You know, I'm like, the last trip we did was, we had 10 layovers. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not into that. But for those who are, there it is. There's the challenge waiting for you. And that watercraft that you had, you guys, the videos showed some amazing speed that if you could maintain, might change the time to beat. Yeah.
Well, it's fun to think about anyway.
Yes, exactly. Steve Landig, Connor Landig, and Mark Churchill, thank you so very much for participating in this V-Wave podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
You're very welcome. Hey, you guys take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You too. Bye-bye.
See ya.